Hi there, and welcome back to Preoccupied. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. Sexton. He is a professor at George Washington University and a therapist.
So what Dr. Sexton does at George Washington University is he's a professor in the Doctor of Psychology program. So what he does, in addition to being a practicing clinician, is help students who are on their way to being practicing clinicians themselves.
Yeah, so this dude knows a lot about therapy.
Yeah, and a lot about the process of therapy, because, like, it's his job to teach.
So when you're training to be a therapist, there are some certain tools you can keep in your back pocket to be able to connect with people pretty quickly.
One of the tools that Dr. Sexton mentions in the interview is mirroring.
And if you're like me, this might take you back to your sixth grade theater class when, like, you get paired up in your improv games and you have to, you and another person stand across from each other, and one person is the lead and the other person follows. You wave your hand, the other person waves their reflective hand like a mirror. And in a more subtle way, mirroring kind of works the same way.
It's a easy way to build rapport with a client. Yeah, and it can also be a great way to create connection between yourself and other people just in daily life.
Yeah, so, like, you know, if you have a job interview, you have a date. If you have a date, this is an excellent way to make your partner feel listened to and, like, you guys are just really on the same wavelength. They're only going to recognize that subconsciously and be left with this feeling of, like, wow, I really liked Jake. He just seems to really get me, you know? Like, even though Jake knows he used his toolbox, and he knows that if Stephanie leans forward and he leans forward, then he seems more interested in what she's saying, more engaged in their conversation.
Yeah. Even things as simple as, you know, reaching to take a drink at the same time. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
I was at dinner with my grandma last night, and she was, you know, just talking. Like, I was like, let me use some of my psychological principles to make her feel heard and seen. So, like, in a way, it's just a way of expressing your interest. And the thing is that you might already be doing it without even knowing that you're doing it.
A lot of people do. Even if you watch, like, a pair of people, maybe a couple at a dinner in a restaurant, you will see them reach for their glass at the same time to take a drink.
Yeah, or if one has their legs crossed in some way, the other one reciprocates it. It's very good. It's a very good thing to keep in mind when you're people watching. It kind of adds a layer to look out for.
And that kind of brings back to what this is all about. It may seem manipulative, but when it comes down to it, we psychologists are interested in how people behave. Mm-hmm. And this is a part of how people behave. So we're going to talk about it.
Yeah. So sometimes mirroring can be more effective than showing all of that super interested body language. If the person who's across from you is leaned back in their chair with their arms folded, kind of like talking and like looking around while they're talking, if you're leaned forward with intent focus, then that might seem like, oh, this person seems like a little high strung, a little over eager, you know? But if you were to reciprocate their energy and have a more casual posture, then that would probably be more effective than, well, actually, this is not based on research. This is just my assumption.
Let's talk about mirroring.
Yeah. In that case, mirroring might be more effective.
Yeah. And now this also isn't based off research. This is just like my gut feeling based on research that I know of. Like when you talk about like power posing and stuff, open body language indicates power. So if you're talking to someone who's more reserved and you have very open body language, they may feel threatened.
Yeah.
There's like another thing there, going back to the evolutionary part of our brain.
Yeah. Man, we are all over the place with this one. I love, this stuff is so interesting to me though.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's like mirroring is a way to meet somebody where they're at, is kind of how I see it as well. Because I definitely feel that. I feel like the more reserved one, somebody comes on really strong, it's not, I don't have a pleasant feeling towards them. But if I'm like, well, me and this girl, we really vibe, you know, like, because we're both seem more laid back in that moment, or if I'm in one of my more high-strung moods and that person is giving that back to me, like, why am I still talking?
No, it makes perfect sense. It, you know, goes back to what we learned in social psychology, where you're more likely to like someone who is similar to you.
Yeah.
Not only in, like, static characteristics, but in your behavior in the moment. And that also comes back to mirroring.
Absolutely.
And another thing we talked about in social psychology was mirror neurons.
That's right. So we have this information about, like, body language. Why is that so important? Well, it's because of something that is called mirror neurons are actually a relatively recent discovery, which is really exciting for people who study things like empathy or
just
modeling.
Just people who are interested in the brain.
Yeah.
Mirror neurons are neurons in our brains that fire both when we complete an action and when we watch someone else complete the action. So what that looks like is if I'm going to reach and take a drink from my water bottle, you can watch certain neurons firing in my brain. Then if Maddie over there takes a drink from her water bottle, those mirror neurons will also fire in my brain as if I were taking a drink from my water bottle.
So mirror neurons are kind of the biological mechanism that makes things like modeling or following an example or monkey see, monkey do, whatever you want to call it, be a process that happens so intuitively. Mirror neurons are kind of what drive our social learning.
And all of our knowledge about mirror neurons comes from this really cool and accidental study that happened with some monkeys many years ago. Or not that many years ago. But I'll definitely put a link to either the study itself or a video about the study in the show notes.
Yeah. Wait, Zenon, how did you learn so much about mirror neurons?
I don't know. I can't quite remember where I learned that thing that I was just talking about.
Did you come up with that?
No, but it's strange how sometimes, like, when you learn something, you forget where you learned the thing, but you still trust the knowledge. Huh.
I wonder. It's like a it's so crazy. Like, where you got it, you don't remember.
Yeah. Like that effect, source amnesia, which I learned about in some psychology class in the past.
Yeah, that, probably legit.
Yeah, exactly. That it happens a lot where when you learn something, you lose where you learned it because that's not really relevant information once you know it or you think you know it.
No, that's a good point. If we do kind of recycle the things that aren't as useful as some theories state, then why would you need to know that you learned that from your AP psych textbook 3 years ago?
Exactly. Like, I just know that the porcupine effect is a thing. I couldn't tell you where I learned about it, but
it's sorry, Dr. Rapon.
I could tell you where I learned about it because I paid very close attention in Dr. Rapon's social psychology class.
Yes, and you should too.
Both times that I took it.
That doesn't sound good.
No, it doesn't sound good. It's you see, normally that means I did so poorly that I failed. But in this case, it means I did well enough that I got to be her SI leader. So,
flex. Yep. So, source amnesia is something that we talk about with Dr. Sexton when we're thinking about how these theories, you know, some of these theories in social psych and clinical psych come to America. And honestly, it's something that we see a lot more than I think we might realize. For example, I love stand-up comedy. And there are a lot of times if I'm trying to write something or like if I'm watching somebody else on Netflix or whatever, where you'd be like, okay, I've definitely heard that joke before, or that was an easy joke, you know? But while you're writing, a joke comes to you by the grace of God, you know, like you're struck by this lightning bolt of inspiration. You're like, what a great joke. God, that's hilarious. It's like, oh, John Mulaney made that joke 3 years ago in that special that I watched one time. And it just seeped into your thoughts. And you're like, oh, what a great idea, Maddie.
Yeah, so that's one idea as to how social psychology made it from German refugee psychologists in the World War II time to their students, who then presented social psychological theories of their own.
Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily... Does it count as copycatting if you didn't know you were...
Exactly. Like, was it plagiarism if you didn't know you were plagiarizing? For any students out there, the answer to that question is yes. So track your sources carefully. But...
On that note, we have some super original answers to lots of our questions from Dr. Sexton. So with no further ado, here is our conversation.
Dr. Sexton.
Hi, Dr. Sexton. This is Maddie from Preoccupied.
Hey, how's it going?
Awesome, awesome. Seems like everything's working on our side as far as recording goes, so I guess that we'll go ahead and get started.
Sounds great.
All right. So we're here with Dr. Sexton today. Could you briefly describe your background? How did you get to where you are now?
Well, it pretty much involves cats and pianos.
Say more right now.
There we go. I was supposed to be a neurologist. And I was taking all the bio classes and the like, and I did great dissecting the frog, I did great dissecting the pig, and then they put a cat in front of me, and I switched. So then I went into psychology. And I was all set. I was seeing people at the crisis hotline, and I was doing behavioral training. And I was all set to be a clinical psychologist. And I was working in a lab with a wonderful man, and he would have us over for lab meetings, and he'd play a piano. He had done some work as a concert pianist before, and he convinced all of us in this very charming environment that if we really wanted to save the world, why do it one person at a time? You can do social psychology and save the world all together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I went into social psych. And then after that, I worked in social psych for a while, and I worked for the government. We worked on a number of contracts with a number of different agencies, and we did some good work. But what I found was that often the results would just kind of disappear into the air. And so I went back into clinical psychology so I could have more of a one-to-one connection with people and have a real sense that I was doing something in the world.
Right, some more tangible outcomes then.
Yeah.
Okay, so how does your knowledge of clinical psychology and social psychology intersect in your work in both those fields?
They inform each other a lot, actually. It's really a wonderful overlap to have. It's good to keep in mind that social psychology, as it's actually done, is really personality and social psychology. You can see that in the name of the journals, Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin and the Journal of Social Psychology and Personality. Right, Journal of Personality. Yeah, there we go. So they do intersect a lot. And of course, social psych is all about the situation. Personality is all about the internal factors. And so it's really relevant. The clinical psych. And one thing I love is that social psych really emphasizes how power plays out and for individuals and in the interaction, and how it can really have a strong influence on people that we don't easily attend to. And so it does make me very conscious of power dynamics and how they can bias my view of the person or bias the interaction.
Yeah, so you really get a mix of that situational perspective and that dispositional perspective to form behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the training that clinicians receive in general prepare them to deal with diverse populations? And then coming from your knowledge on social psychology and power dynamics, how might that be improved?
One big thing that we focus on is the whole idea that when it comes to communicating with others, there's audio, the content that you're conveying, and then there's also a lot of the nonverbal cues that can even come out in an audio context, but not the content of your words, but how you say them, but also in terms of an interpersonal. There's the old joke that therapists lean back to avoid contagion from their patients. And that kind of thing can play out in the room, especially with diverse populations. And the research strongly suggests that when you're talking to someone, you're paying attention to what you're actually saying. But what they're paying attention to, a lot of ways, is are you leaning in? The expressions on your face, are they flowing freely? What are the expressions on your face? In terms of the tone that you convey the words in, is it warm? Is it approachable? Or is it cold? Is it nervous? Is it halting? And a lot of those can really convey your implicit attitudes towards a group to right. them. But the trick is you pay only attention to the words you're saying, so you think you're being brave. And they recognize that you have a problem.
Right. So it's a lot more obvious to the people receiving that subtle cold shoulder than to the person subtly cold shouldering.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the disconnect is really dangerous, though, because they will have a negative reaction to you, and you don't have a clue, and you think it's them.
All right. So what are some ways that therapists can identify their own biases, then, in order to be able to reduce them?
I absolutely love video supervision, because then you can really see it on the screen, and it's really hard for the person to avoid the fact that it's like, yeah, you know, you were like halting and their eyes seeing you with other people. You were different here, and you were leaning away and you weren't meeting their gaze. What was that all about?
Right, then they can't really avoid that. They kind of have to confront themselves then in their own biases.
Yeah, I'm getting a second opinion on that too from someone else who's looking with some more objective eyes.
And so when there isn't video, it can be wonderful to try to interact with the person maybe in the waiting room or something and have like one of your fellow students or someone watch and kind of give you some feedback about it. It's like, honestly, you know, you do seem to be kind of holding back, or like you're afraid, or like you're nervous, or even hostile, which is difficult, but you have to be open to that.
Yeah, you have to be open to that that feedback.
So in talking with different professors and clinicians and stuff, we've heard a lot about how different diagnoses can carry like a stigma with them, like schizophrenia or borderline personality disorder, and kind of cause therapists to view their clients differently because of that. So then, again, with your experience in both social and clinical psychology, kind of what's your perspective on this and how do you think that might be remedied?
Yes, it is definitely true that the diagnosis that the person has will cause them to view. The therapist will view the patient differently, and it will also influence how the patient interacts with and views the therapist, especially once the therapist has diagnosed them. But when we talk about personality disorders and when we talk about personality in general, there's kind of a tendency to strive towards simplicity and reduce the person to, you know, a single or a few really manageable dimensions. And so there is a tendency and a temptation to view everything that they do as stemming from borderline personality and assuming that everything they're going to do will reflect borderline personality. And there's a definite self-fulfilling prophecy there where, you know, if I talk to someone who has borderline personality disorder a lot about self-harm and the like, it does kind of set up, you know, an understanding and an expectation that, you know, this is part of who you are. And it can even sadly have the side effect of really kind of encouraging that.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. We talk a lot about self-fulfilling prophecies in the diagnostic process of whether these sort of, you know, being able to name something can either be really helpful or harmful depending on the person or what that diagnosis is.
And it's difficult because you do need to check in about these important issues. But the trick is checking in gently in a way that, you know, doesn't necessarily make it seem inevitable and, you know, walking away from it when it seems like you've done your due diligence and there doesn't seem to be anything there, not really belaboring it.
So you work as a clinical psychologist now, yes?
I am, yeah.
Yeah. How do you foster rapport with your clients?
A big way to foster rapport is to do a lot of mirroring. And it's really kind of analogous to the social psych research on attraction. So you can do really subtle mimicking of facial expression, subtle mimicking of body language. In terms of there's Bebe's work, actually, that deals with attachment, that talks about how essential it is for rapport of mothers and their infants. And I actually talked with her wife. She didn't have more fathers. And she said she would love to, but just aren't willing to show up for the lab. But in terms of mothers and their infants, there's micro expressions that occur within less than a second that are exchanged between the baby and the mother, where the mother will initially mirror back whatever affect the child is sending her way. So if the child is upset, you'll see a little look of distress appear in the mother's face. And then it usually gets transformed to a more healthier or adaptive emotional experience and broadcast back to the child. But the initial reflection is really key in terms of developing that connection and sense of trust. It's really a very immediate way of feeling heard and of hearing someone. And so when I'm listening to the stories and talking with them, you know, if they lean forward, I lean forward. If they reach their hand out, I'll slightly reach my hand out as well. And I'll just engage in very natural mirroring of them. And when they're showing distress on their face, I'll allow myself to show, you know, a quick expression of distress. It kind of mirrors it, a look of concern, a look of worry, a look of sadness, to really kind of echo and develop that empathic rapport so they know I'm attending to every experience that they have and feeling a small mirror of that within myself.
Wow, that is so interesting. So by mirroring, it's kind of a very fundamental way to bond with another person, even if they don't realize that it's happening.
Yeah, when I first started, I did it in a really primitive way. I'd be like, wow, you know, that sounds hard, but so.
Yeah, now is it kind of a reflex or?
Yeah, it was just, you know, I was panicked and worried and all the rest, and it was hard to really engage fully in the moment because I had so many meta concerns about, you know, am I doing it right? Am I hurting people? Am I helping people? What's going on? But now that I have a lot more experience, I can kind of relax and be in the moment with them and allow myself to really try to feel what they're feeling as well. And, you know, asking them to say more, explain more. It's like, you know, I'd really like to be there with you in that moment. Can you kind of talk me through it and help me really understand, you know, how the whole thing played out?
So reflecting in a lot of ways, really.
Yeah, it's like I really want to be, you know, almost inside your mind. I want to see it as it's playing out. I want to feel it as it's playing out. And it's interesting because I have two young kids, and when they come home from school, they'll start talking about something. And I kind of had to slow them down and be like, I'm not at school with you. I don't know who he is when you say he. I don't know. You know, like, kind of slow them down, walk me through it. We do kind of have that weird sense that, you know, the person was there with us in the moment. So it's important to pull these things out. And,
yeah.
And then kind of bringing it back to the concept of like countertransference too, where you're feeling what the client or the patient is feeling, and that helps to treat them better. And then before the next question, just to ask, do you prefer the term patient or client for people who come to see you in therapy?
My original training and actually my undergraduate degree as well really emphasize the existential and humanistic approaches. So my default really is to kind of go with client, but I appreciate and respect the use of patient as well to really kind of give a greater sense of what's actually going on.
Okay. Yeah, because that's something we've heard a lot about in talking to different people too, is the nuances between those and who prefers which one.
Yeah, the connotations of each.
Yeah, but so in your practice, what kinds of clients do you see, and what problems do they come to therapy with?
Well, I'm an old guy, so I can only see old men. I do get a lot of referrals, but and people actually refer to me because they're dealing with individuals who are older men. But also, you know, you're in Psychology Today, and people can look up and see your picture. And they, generally speaking, people tend to go with what feels familiar and feels close to them. So since I'm an older man, they generally tend to pick me. I specialize in depression, and I specialize in chronic pain.
Okay. And then do you use the humanistic existential model when treating those things, or have you collected other approaches over the years as well?
I'm integrative, so I use a number of different theories and approaches depending on what seems to meet their needs and what they feel most comfortable with. Working with guys, I tend to find a lot of them really do prefer the concrete and goal-focused approaches, like acceptance and commitment therapy, especially since I work with chronic pain. It's pretty well established for that. Using that as a base, it's not uncommon to move into motion-focused therapy, dynamic therapy to work on improving the relationships in their life, and also existential therapy to the extent that they are facing crises about identity and meaning in life.
Wow, yeah. So when you do get a client who maybe doesn't like quite fit into the same demographic as you, what are ways that you compensate for that dissimilarity to still have that trust?
Well, I'm unlike an inpatient setting, I'm in an outpatient setting, so I do kind of have the luxury of they sought me out for some reason.
Right.
So usually there's something about me that is a draw. In terms of like sexuality or ethnicity or religion or culture, I kind of have the benefit of being a little ambiguous in a lot of dimensions, so people often feel free to read into me whatever feels the most comfortable. In terms of people who sought me out because I'm not similar to them, usually they have sought me out because I'm similar to an important individual in their life.
Right.
So I get a lot of individuals who had a really strong relationship with their dad or with their grandfather or some other figure like that.
Okay, so that makes really a lot of sense.
Use that as a springboard.
Yeah, that's definitely really interesting. Okay, so then to bring it back to the social psychology side of things, you mentioned earlier that you had some interesting things to say about the history of social psychology. Would you be able to tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I was at a conference in Germany, and we were talking about social psych, and it was really interesting because there was a group of them that got a little agitated. And as things became clear, they were talking about how they really kind of resented the way that social psych was really stolen by America from Germany, because it was a very German, initially, a very German pursuit. A lot of theorists and the like were from Germany and in Germany. And it was really kind of interesting to hear them say that, because it's like, well, you kind of started the war.
Yeah,
that's a good point, actually. Yeah,
that's kind of interesting, because like what we've been taught is that social psychology started as an American response to the awful things that they saw in the Second World War, to try and understand that and how people could do that.
There's a lot of truth to that, but there is a deeper complexity, and that part of that time, part of that response was also due to a lot of individuals. And like they say, we stole a lot of individuals. Like Fritz Heider actually was just down the road from me at Smith College. He was not alive at the same time that I was there. But he'd ended up at Smith College, and they had part of the library that had a lot of his original books and notebooks and everything. So many of the individuals who really got social psych going and who were actually reacting and thinking a lot about World War II were actually people who were escaping the events leading up to World War II and leaving the country and coming over here. And so they were a lot of German researchers. Many of them were Gestaltists. Many of them were analysts or dynamic individuals who had a very strong perspective. And when they came to the United States, I mean, they did recognize this is my new life. This is my new academic career. And so there was a lot of translation of Gestalt ideas. And it was really interesting to read Heider's textbooks that he'd written in and his notebooks, because you could really see the way he was trying to find words that would be acceptable in America to express his concepts. And so a lot of the original Gestalt and dynamic analytic theories kind of got transformed and watered down. And if you want, you could read up. Roy Baumeister actually did a great job of kind of documenting and demonstrating how a lot of social psych took a lot of the same issues and concerns, like things with defense mechanisms, and really took those concepts, changed the wording, but continued to use the concepts, and really demonstrated the validity and utility of but using very, American behaviorist, cognitive-oriented language. But it was still the same concept.
Wow, yeah. No, I've never heard that explanation before. It's kind of a hidden history.
And ending up at the college actually is important, because they would teach people at the college level these ideas, and then they would go into grad school. And as we all know, when it comes to the attribution of ideas, if there's any sort of time that lapses, you forget who originally said it, and it becomes your idea.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the German professors came over, and they were teaching at the undergraduate level. And so they weren't really being correctly cited or identified as the inspiration of the ideas that the graduate students would develop in their theses and then their later work. And so there's this big transformation where a lot of the original ideas were transformed in a way. But if you go back and you look, you can really see how a great deal of Gestalt and analytic ideas were persisted. Like the whole idea of attachment is a very dynamic conceptualization that has been very rich in terms of generating research and ideas and treatment. But it's really a transformation of the original.
Wow, so then kind of source amnesia occurs, and suddenly a lot of Americans are having some very good ideas.
Exactly. Yeah. And the funny thing is that some of the core concepts that were diluted down have come back in later years. And like social psych at some point decided, you know what, we left motivation and drive out of the whole story.
Right.
And they've kind of gone back and tried to reintroduce it. And which is funny, because it was there originally. They intentionally downplayed it so it would sell with American audiences. But
yeah, kind of got to dumb it ultimately down for us, right?
Yeah, make it more palatable.
Exactly, yeah. And they couldn't live without it, essentially, so they had to bring it back.
So in what ways do you think that your field has changed in the past couple of decades?
For me, the most wonderful thing was along bringing back drives and motivations as being core and central to our theories again, is emotion. So if you go back and you look at old Journal of Personality and Social Psychologies, they at some point, if you look at the old covers, they'll announce a decade of emotion. And it was absent for the longest time. And then I think it was when I was a grad student, they decided, you know what, emotions are actually kind of important. And they really, yeah, it's a weird idea to live without them, but whatever. They brought them back, and I really enjoy that, and I've been happy to see that.
Okay, so emotions have been playing a more important role than in recent years.
As an independent variable, a dependent variable, just weaving it back in central to the studying the human experience.
Right.
Yeah, so kind of seeing how it affects things as well as how things affect emotion. Okay, so then how do you think that social and clinical psychology will continue to develop over the next few decades?
That's a great question. In terms of clinical psych, a big thing that I've seen is there's increasing emphasis on integration, and I see people reaching out more and more for more complex ideas, more complex models. We really strongly emphasize, you know, Occam's razor and simplicity at the very beginning, and now we're moving further and further away from that. And one big way that that's playing out is in statistics. A lot of people have become increasingly uneasy with the way that individuals have been going about using statistics, and so there's more of an emphasis on models and model fit and understanding, you know, how useful a model is versus significance testing and demonstrating mean differences between groups and comparing that in an inferential fashion in a way that, honestly, the assumptions don't tend to hold true. And so we may be making a lot out of a little, and we may be ignoring some really big things, but they struggle with significance testing. So they're kind of been left by the wayside. There's also, in terms of psych, been an increasing emphasis on qualitative methods, which I think gets at another way of understanding that can really round out the whole model. So I see us getting back to a place where we're more willing to think big and bring in a lot of different elements rather than try to focus in on some narrow slice that can really be honestly misleading.
Wow, okay. Yeah, we haven't heard any answer quite like that. That's a really interesting perspective on it.
Yes.
Yeah, it may be funny, but a lot of what you learn may disappear soon. Which is funny to me, but maybe not to you.
Yeah, kind of like if you take a programming course, you know, by the time you're done with the course, the language you just learned is obsolete, like that kind of thing.
Exactly. I know Fortran and Pascal. Who knows Fortran and Pascal?
Yeah, my mom was just telling me yesterday about how she had to learn Fortran in college, and I looked at her, what the heck is Fortran? Yep.
I know. Sounds like a 1980s synth band or something.
Yeah.
How do you think that studying both social and clinical psychology, how has that changed how you interact with others and interact with the world around you?
There's actually an interesting body of research that talks about thinking social psychologically. Really? And I'm blanking on the author's name, but they even have a test that you can take of 20 items that really demonstrates your ability to think in a way that echo social psych research very well.
Huh.
And so before you get too excited, it's not a superpower. These individuals actually tend to be more introverted and more higher neuroticism, more depressed, more prone towards negative emotionality. A lot of social psychologists turn to positive psychology. You'll see like Seligman and many, like Ahrens and many others, start out studying a lot of social psych phenomena. Like I've done research on, you know, racism and stereotyping and homophobia. And, you know, we end up studying things like gratitude and awe and how that's important, because it can get fairly overwhelming to kind of repeatedly be exposed to how people can really view others in a way that is disappointing, and how hard it is for them to really see and recognize that they're doing what they're doing, and how easy it is for them to deny that there's anything wrong in what they're doing. So we do often kind of turn to that as a way to kind of, you know, feel a little better about the world that we live in.
Yeah.
So then does that neuroticism come from studying how people can be so unaware of the impact of their actions on others, or even like callous towards that, or not care about how their actions impact others? So is it studying that might cause some of that neuroticism, if I understand what you said correctly?
Well, they were kind of looking at it as it naturally occurs in individuals. In my experience going through a grad program, I know that, and also working with people in my career, I know that even if they didn't start out that way, it does kind of pull and drag at you to repeatedly kind of see the world. I mean, we're wonderful to people that we identify with, and we're wonderful to people that, you know, we are some sort of connection or attachment to. But once you get outside of that bubble, things change. And that can, you know, kind of wear on you. And the idea that some people are like that naturally coming into it, I'm not aware of research on it, but my personal hypothesis is that they've experienced it firsthand. And it explains both why they think psychologically or social psychologically, and also why they're more prone towards negative affect, because they've experienced the discrimination, they've experienced the exclusion, they've experienced the harmful side of group building.
So being a social psychologist, do you find that when you go to a cocktail party or something, do you find yourself being able to be present, or do you find yourself kind of being aware of these concepts throughout your daily life?
I would definitely say I'm aware of them, and I will often kind of lightheartedly tease people and prod them to go in a, you know, a different way, a different direction. When they do engage in this, I try to be, you know, whimsical about it and playful about it. I don't want to bring everyone down. But, yeah, I can't. If you're asking, can I turn it off? Not really, no. I don't like to see that kind of thing going on. So.
Right. Yeah, no, we find that ourselves. Like, Zenon and I will be trying to have just, you know, talking about, you know, I was talking to this person today. It's kind of interesting. Do you remember from social psych what they said about, you know, then we end up talking about our coursework pretty much. it's hard to, it just makes so much sense, and it is so applicable. It's hard to turn it off once you have it planted in, that seed planted in your head.
It is. And especially between the two of you, you can kind of practice the jokes that you might use to kind of, that way you can express it in a way that's not threatening.
Yeah, a little less.
Oh yeah, that's part of why psych is so appealing too, is because when we're studying the psychology of how people behave, it is so applicable into everyday life.
Yeah, it makes you know, being in the waiting room or like you're going to a party just that much more engaging, you know, for sure.
So remember, there's a huge social psych effect that we find where it just really often takes one person to kind of like gently bring people's attention to something to really make a profound difference. And even if the guilty parties don't change their behavior, the person who is, you know, kind of under the gun will see and recognize and appreciate, you know, that someone did stand for them. I always love that Mr. Rogers quote when talking about bad things happening, is that it's always important to kind of look and see that, generally speaking, when you see bad things happening, it's sad to see the bad thing that's happening. But if you look at the bigger picture, you'll see many other people rushing in to try to fix it and help it and make it better. So if you're the person where the bad thing's happening and you see people, you know, kind of reaching out to you, trying to help you, I think it can make all the world of a difference.
So in tragedy, there is also a lot of humanity.
Yep. Okay, so to close it out with one final question. If you could go back in time to when you were an undergraduate and tell yourself one thing, what would that be?
It is cliche, but it's very true. Actually, I worked at one point for the Department of Education, and we did track how many different careers people had in their lives, and it just seemed to keep expanding. But that I would go back and tell myself that, you know, things aren't going to turn out how you expect. They're going to be different, and in a lot of ways, they'll be better. So just kind of follow the path that's in front of you, and, you know, things will turn out different, but probably better than you can imagine.
Yeah, we've been...
Like, I have 2 degrees. I didn't plan on that.
Right. No, yeah, that is something to definitely keep in mind. Like, right now, Zenon and I are both sophomores, you know, and Already we're being encouraged to think about grad school and do research that you might want to study in grad school and like what's your ultimate goal for the rest of your life. We're like 19 and don't even know what to wear when we wake up in the morning. How are we supposed to know these things? So it's definitely a relief to hear people say like it's okay to go with the opportunities that present themselves to you, even if it's not exactly what you planned. If it's exciting, follow that gut instinct and the things that arise for a reason.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said for like it is important to do things and be active, but at the end of the day, if you spend all your life doing things for something that may or may not ever happen, then it's really kind of an open question over whether or not that was a life worth living.
Wow. Certainly gives us a lot to think about.
Yeah, for sure.
There we go. It's a beautiful day. Go have fun.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. That's all that we have for you.
Yeah, unless there's anything else you'd like to add or say.
I think it's great that you are doing this. It's wonderful to have a chance to talk to you. It's wonderful to hear your questions. I really admire what you're doing there.
Thank you so much. We really love getting to talk to people like you, getting to pick your brains about all these different things and hearing perspectives that we don't really get to hear about from Google or our textbooks, you know? So we really can't express how much we appreciate you taking your time.
Yeah, for sure. And it really helps with that whole process of trying to find what field is most appealing and, you know, kind of where we want to orient ourselves as we're progressing through school and such. So
hopefully some other kids can learn about it too if they tune in.
Yeah, for sure. Getting to hear from you as both a clinician and as a social psychologist has been really helpful. Thank you.
I'm glad I could help.
Absolutely. Well, enjoy the rest of your day and thank you so much again.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sexton, for coming on our podcast, for talking to us about your clinical work, about the hidden history of social psychology, and all the great other things that came up in that discussion.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, rate, subscribe, follow, whatever, our podcast on wherever you're listening to us, and tell your friends about it, like us on Facebook.
Check us out on Twitter.
Yes.
Visit our website, if it exists. and if it exists, the link will be at the bottom of the show notes. If it doesn't exist, the link might still be at the bottom of the show notes. Who knows? You'll find out when you visit. check out the bottom of the show notes for all of these great things and the rest of the show notes for links to all the great things that we talked about in this episode.
Yeah. And if you have a friendly neighborhood psychologist you'd like us to interview, have some interesting things for us to all discuss, please, please, please send us a message, email, whatever. We want to talk to them.
Thank you for listening. See you next time on Preoccupied. We can even be like one of those cool interview radio shows that includes the ringing on the...
Build the anticipation.
Yep. Mirror neurons.
Mirror neuron, mirror.
Mirror neuron.
Wah, 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 wah.
Wah, wah, wah.